From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. Today we listen to an encore edition of our program. In the first half hour, my conversation with Theodore Roszak from last year. In 1969, Roszak wrote the award-winning social commentary, The Making of a Counterculture. His latest work is a call to arms for the same generation called The Making of an Elder Culture. Then in the second half hour, we talk to three older Iowans who will tell us how they've maintained a social consciousness from the 1960s or developed one in their second act. Can elder culture transform our society? We'll find out right after this news update. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and today you're listening to an encore edition of the program. In 1969, historian Theodore Roszak's The Making of a Counterculture coined the term that defined a generation. His new book, The Making of an Elder Culture, explores the potential social sea change resulting from a gerontocracy in which most of Western society is over the age of 50. Roszak is Professor Emeritus of History at California State University. Professor Theodore Roszak joins us this half hour by phone from Berkeley. Good afternoon, Professor.
Yes, hello. You can call me Ted if you wish.
Okay, very good, Ted. Call me Ben, please.
All right.
You make the claim that baby boomers have a second chance to reshape history, and even that boomers' place in history could hinge more on their second act as elders than their first act as radicals 40 years ago. Explain.
Well, every older generation has its own collective personality, depending upon what it has lived through. You know, my parents and grandparents were still in touch with the hard times of a depression, for example, in which elders were expected to be poor and to retire to the margins of the society. But the boomer generation is a very different generation, and it has come into the world as the best educated, the most widely traveled, most widely read older generation we've ever seen. It has, moreover, been exposed in its early years to many daring ideas, to radical ideas of social change, to multicultural values. This is all part of the history and, as I would put it, the personality of this older generation, which is now going to be old for much longer than it was ever young. So if it can recapture the energy and the vitality of its early years, it will carry all of that into its senior years. Now, I'm not talking about the whole 77 million baby boomers. I mean, I respect the fact that this is a spectrum of American society, and it includes conservatives as well as radicals, reactionaries as well as revolutionaries. I mean, it includes everything. But within that spread, there are a certain number of boomers who can still draw upon the daring, the audacious energies of their youth. And there's no reason why they can't, as they look around for something to do with their retirement years, go back and pick up some of the unfinished business of the 1960s and perhaps do a better job of realizing those ideals than they could when they were young.
You write in this book that the free market and the elder culture are not viewed as compatible because elders are seen as a liability, not as an asset. But in this book, you propose some new economic indicators. Explain those.
Well, America is always going to be, to some degree, a free market economy. I mean, that's part of our national character. But we also have, and have developed for over a century, a very large public sector, the purpose of which is to take care of all the problems that can't be done on a profit-making basis. Well, the most obvious things are the entitlements of seniors, Social Security, Medicare. There's no way programs of this importance and magnitude could be carried on a competitive free market basis. I mean, there are people who have tried to come up with ideas like that, but we know from the experience of other societies and our own that this is, as the societies age, what we call the public sector, the tax-supported public sector, expands because there's so much more need in that society for what elders require. That's why I say at the very beginning of the book, you know, I have a chapter called Maturity Rules, in the sense that as societies age, the more and more of the resources of the society, and that means tax dollars, are moved into those parts of our society that elders most require. And that will change the entire nature of the American economic system. It won't revolutionize it, but it will change it. For example, I anticipate that by the middle of this century, we're going to be willing to accept the idea that we are a healthcare economy, in the same way that in the mid-20th century, we thought of ourselves as an automotive economy, where most people found their jobs and most businesses found their profits in automobiles. Well, we now know it's not a very good thing to be an automotive economy. It can be very risky and in many ways very destructive. But healthcare, on the other hand, far from being a liability, is that part of our economy where people find long life and good health, and there are going to be more and more people working in healthcare because you can't outsource healthcare, not significantly. And there will be more and more businesses making their profits in healthcare, and there will be more and more technology dedicated to healthcare until finally we'll say, well, you know, we are a healthcare economy, and what's wrong with that? In fact, that's good. And I think that change will come almost automatically, whether people, regardless of people's ideological persuasion, they will find that we are moving the way other highly developed industrial economies have moved, into an era of healthcare economics.
You predict, in fact, that the major impetus for change will come from a sort of a revolt of female caregivers looking after older disabled family members. Explain what you think will happen in this scenario.
Well, I think this is like a time bomb waiting to explode. We have, for generations now, depended upon families to take care of the needs of the elder generation. And I'm talking about the extreme needs, health care, and perhaps everything down to moving people around from a bed to a wheelchair and around the house and so on. That kind of care is now entirely unloaded on families. They have to pay for it, and somebody in the family, it's usually the woman, has to give up a career, and after raising her own children, now has to take care of her parents. And that's been the pattern in our society. But what we're facing now is the fact that there are going to be a great many more elders than ever before, and they're going to live a lot longer. And so that kind of care now becomes a sort of a burden that you can't reasonably expect families to handle on the basis of their own income and their own energy. In fact, they can't even do it well enough because a lot of the care now for elders is highly technical. I mean, you have to know how to give an injection, to set up an IV line. You may have to deal with tricky medications. You may have to deal with psychological depression. These are far beyond the demands of previous generations. And so I suspect within the next 10 years or so, the home health care providers of our society, and they will largely be the daughters of elders, are going to say, look, enough. We can't handle this much. We're being asked to give up our careers, things we were trained for and educated for. We brought up our children, and now we're suddenly being expected to be amateur caregivers, nurses, psychologists. I mean, we just can't do that. And at that point, we're going to have to expand Medicare to include what it does not now include, and that's continuing home care.
What does this all mean, this prediction, these trends, mean for the political parties on their present courses, especially given the context of the present health care debate, controversy?
Yeah, well, you know, what I'm talking about here is really big. This is a big change. It will come gradually and then by fits and starts. But if that much of our resources is flowing in the direction of an aging society, those resources are not going to be there for other purposes. Let me suggest one: war. It's going to be a lot harder for us to afford wars when we have to afford health care and social security for an older generation. And in effect, we will be in the same situation other highly developed industrial societies are in. We will have to put more and more of our resources into what is, after all, a very humane, very constructive, very good use, rather than using those resources, well, say, for space shots or space shuttles or making war. I mean, the money just won't be there, and the interest won't be there.
What signs should we be looking for? You say you gave a window in the next 10 years or so. What signs will we be reporting on here in the news that you would say will be signs of this shift in social consciousness?
Well, it's not as if what I'm talking about becomes a series of news stories of some kind. I mean, that's the most important thing to remember. We're talking about a demographic trend. And it's a demographic trend which is unstoppable. It's inevitable. Nobody knows of any way to stop societies from aging, and nobody wants to. I mean, aging in good health is a very good thing. It's a great accomplishment. Any society that can, you know, keep raising its national life expectancy is doing a good job. I mean, ask yourself, you know, think of all the economic indicators there are, and then compare them with just one, what I call the national life expectancy. In societies where life expectancy is going down, you wouldn't want to live there. There must be something very wrong with that society.
For instance, Russia.
That's right. The Russians are, you know, their life expectancy is shortening. And it's for definable reasons, but I mean, it's not something we want to see happen elsewhere. And incidentally, it wouldn't even matter that their gross domestic product is going up and up and up if their life expectancy is going down and down and down. So in societies where the national life expectancy is increasing, I would say that's a good measure of prosperity.
We have to take a short break now, and when we come back, we'll continue my conversation from last year with Professor Theodore Roszak. He's the author of the award-winning social commentary, The Making of a Counterculture. That's from 1969. His latest work, The Making of an Elder Culture, talks about using the ideals from the 60s to transform society. Also, when we come back, we'll talk about some other things mentioned in this book, including the idea of the alpha male and how that will fit into the future. Also, a chapter in the book devoted to the end of sex. We'll find out what that means in just a moment. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer with historian Theodore Roszak, The Making of a Counterculture, his big book from 1969, his social commentary, back with The Making of an Elder Culture, sharing with us the hopes that he has for this generation, now that it is moving on into its golden years, and we're talking about the possibilities here. As you've described that, Ted Roszak joins us from Berkeley, California. As you describe that, let me throw a few cons at this idea that you have there. Aren't there a lot of things working against elders being the engine for change? For instance, the health problems and mobility. Young people can do a lot of things older people simply can't endure, correct?
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, there's a difference between being young and being old. I'm certainly aware of that myself. You know, and you have to bear in mind that these two groups that we refer to loosely as the young and the old are not adversarial groups. I mean, demographic groups are not like gender groups or ethnicity groups or social classes. They are bound together by family ties. I mean, the older generation is called mother and father, and the younger generation is called son and daughter. So whatever strains there may be, they are knitted together by the fact that, well, we all become older and we all have children, or most of us do, and then the children replace us as the older generation. This is a natural, organic process in every society. And what I'm, the ideal that I raise in the book is one of the great ideas of the 1960s. Back then, there was a remarkable woman named Maggie Kuhn. Maggie Kuhn launched the Gray Panthers movement. She felt that elders were spending too much time looking after their own interests in society, namely Social Security and Medicare. She said, you know, we've got to get beyond looking after our own interests. We are the elders of the society, and we should be the people who most care about the children, the coming generation. That's the job of good elders. Well, the Gray Panthers are still around. They're one of the groups I recommend to people if they want to get involved in generational politics. I mean, I receive tremendous amounts of email from Gray Panther groups on every issue under the sun, not just the issues of old people. And I think that's commendable, that the older generation comes to have a sense of responsibility for the deal that they have cut with our society, namely that they are given a retirement income. It's not a great deal of money, but it's for many, it's what they live on. And they have been given a very good deal on health care. And in return, they should have some sense of responsibility to the rest of the society. I indeed raised the possibility in the book, and it's one of the most controversial points, but it's one of the richest ideas, that we could extend the entitlements, Social Security and Medicare, to the entire society so that we would all have the benefit of those great programs. And is it possible? Well, I map out a way in which it is possible.
You mentioned Gray Panthers, of course, the organization linked most closely to older people, AARP. Will they be at the forefront of this social change?
Oh, yes. I mean, these groups are the groups, the first groups to organize older Americans for political purposes. And a great deal of what they seek, I certainly approve of, except that I think those benefits, the benefits of getting older, along with the aches and pains, that these things should be extended to the entire society and they should be universally shared.
You devote a chapter to the end of sex. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, I use the word end as in the sense of the objective of. I think this is one of the big personal changes that we will see happening in our society. You know, we in the 1960s, we developed a sort of cult of youth in which sex played a very big part. Indeed, there was a sexual revolution through the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. And this was the window of time in which there was a generation somewhere between the birth control pill and the very frightful onset of AIDS, where a certain kind of sex, which was often irresponsible sex, but or promiscuous sex, was possible and it was safe. Well, that's no longer the case, but during that period of time, a whole generation grew up seeing sex as the very center of life, practically. And that's why you see so much of it in our advertising, our movies, our popular culture. I mean, you know, if you subtracted sex from advertising, there'd be nothing left, practically. However, it becomes very clear to people by the time they're, say, my age, in your 60s, your 70s, into your 80s, that these are the ideals and the images of youth. And relationships change. They become very different relationships in which loyalty is. I use the word loyalty. Loyalty comes to take the place of romantic love, in which companionship comes to mean more than anything else. You know, the words of the traditional Christian marriage ceremony, in sickness and in health, for richer, for poorer, for better or for worse. Notice the word love is not used there. Other relationships are mentioned. And I think more and more we're going to see that relationships in old age are deeper and richer and more enduring, but not as passionate.
Right. Well, some might say, well, a worthy ideal to strive for, but we are in the age of Viagra.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I mean, I think that's that's partially because the emphasis on sexual performance has been so great ever since the end of the Second World War that it's hard for people to look beyond it or get around it. And I'm not suggesting that, you know, sex will simply stop in the society, but I'm saying that relationships in marriage or man-woman relationships in any context will take on a very different character as people grow older. I mean, everyone who's in their 60s or 70s knows that they are no longer in their teens and 20s, and their relationship with other people of the opposite sex are now very different than they were in the past. We haven't yet explored that as a frontier of human experience, but I think that's going to be one of the major elements in our popular culture.
Ted, we have just about 3 minutes left. I want you to talk about this idea in your book of medical crises as transformative experiences. You have a medical crisis behind you, and it transformed you. Talk about that a bit.
Well, you know, nobody ages in our world today smoothly. Most people enter their senior years through some kind of a medical crisis. I mean, this is so commonplace, we now take it for granted, whether it's a heart bypass surgery or something, you know, even more demanding than that. And if you've been through an experience like that, you may have actually come to death's door and then discovered that your life is going to be saved by the doctors and the nurses and the hospitals. That experience can be deeply transformative. I mean, in my life, it is the most transformative experience I've ever had, to come that close to death and then to be brought back from the edge of the grave.
So for someone who hasn't been there, what is the nature of that transformation?
Well, it makes you sit down and say, what is my life all about? What am I really living for? And you know, you begin to think there are an awful lot of things I've been pursuing that I valued that aren't really worth it. But companionship, love, loyalty, these things really matter.
When we go back to the societal change, how sure are you that this major transformation will take place? At the beginning of our conversation, you called this a plea, and I'm sorry, we only have a minute or so left. You called it a plea, so that makes me think you aren't sure this shift will take place.
Well, the demographic shift will take place because the people are there. The spirit in which that transformation takes place, whether it's done with nobility and grandeur, that's what I'm appealing for.
So you're not sure whether this generation, known for its narcissism, will come out and make some real lasting social
change?
Well,
you know, that's why some of us write books,
because
we want to appeal to the world around us.
Okay, very good. We'll leave it there then. Ted, Professor Theodore Roszak, thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's a great pleasure.
Theodore Roszak is the author of the award-winning social commentary, The Making of a Counterculture, from 1969. He was the man who coined that term, counterculture. His new book is titled The Making of an Elder Culture, and we spoke in December of last year. When we come back, we'll talk with some Iowans who are members of the counterculture generation. We want to explore how they've maintained a social consciousness from the 1960s, or how they've developed one in their second act. I'm Ben Kiefer. We'll be back with more of The Exchange right after an update of the latest news from Iowa Public Radio.
Got a feeling inside. Can't explain. A certain kind. Can't explain. I feel hot and cold. Can't explain. Hey, down my soul. Yeah. Can't explain. I said, can't explain. I'm feeling good now, yeah, but can't explain. Busy in the head now. I'm feeling blue.
And we're back with The Exchange. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we're listening to an encore edition of our program from December of last year, when we're talking about the counterculture generation. In the first half hour, we heard from historian Theodore Roszak, author of The Making of an Elder Culture. That's his new book. His award-winning social commentary was called The Making of a Counterculture, from 1969. And now we want to talk to Iowans who are members of that generation. We want to find out how they've maintained a social consciousness from the 1960s, been shaped by it, or developed one in their second act. I spoke with Bill Ibanez. He worked for many years in the aerospace industry before retirement. He now serves on the Board of Supervisors in Winnesheik County. He has worked with the SCORE program, which provides advice to those starting new businesses. He's also active in the AARP. Good afternoon to you, Bill.
Hello, how are you?
Great to have you with us. I understand you're at a conference and you need to get away, but I would like to have you share a few thoughts with us before you do. You served in the military during the Vietnam War. You were in the Navy in the South Pacific. How did that experience during that time in our society change you and your thinking?
Well, actually, my service time when I went in, it was just I got out in the second half of 63, so the war hadn't really been officially declared. When I was in, it was considered a police action. And, you know, at a high school, you either went to college or you went in the military, and I served my time. I picked the Navy. That was my choice. It wasn't until later on that I really felt the full effect of the war, because I had gotten out. And then a couple of years later, I took the GI Bill. And then I participated with many young kids at that time as I was going through college and engineering that I was in. And we were considered the more conservative group of the campus. In the beginning, my attitude was, hey, guys, I served. You know, you need to serve. And I graduated in 69. And by that time, I think 68 and 69, I had completely changed my viewpoint on that.
Where were you going to college?
I was at Stony Brook out on Long Island.
Right. So by the end of the war, you were not counseling students to join up?
Right. Almost. Well, actually, we were talking to students about Canada. We were talking to students about possibly ways of busting your physical. There was a group of veterans that...
About how to avoid service, in other words.
In other words, yes. Mm-hmm.
That personal transformation that took place with you on a personal level in the 1960s, how has that generation's experience that at a young time in your life stayed with you through your life, guided you in your personal decisions and how you view our society?
Well, I think it really had – I was very trusting up to the time that I got out and went to college. You know, my country, right or wrong. And later on, I realized that the country's made up of many people and leaders can be wrong. And I realized that just blind trust didn't work. So consequently, I think I'm probably more in tune with the current young generation, which really doesn't trust government or doesn't trust big businesses or the, you know, the society as established over many, many years. However, that said, I had quite an urge to help out and volunteer for things.
Which you have done in a great number of cases as well. Now, in our first half hour, you didn't hear it. I know you were involved with your conference. We had Theodore Rozak on. He's talking about your generation with its experience, also the large number, 77 million baby boomers retiring. This culture, this generation... from the 60s, could really make a difference in transforming our society. Do you see that happening?
Well, let's put it this way. I hope they do. I'm kind of disappointed in my generation.
How so?
Well, I mean, we were out there. I would say half of us. We were very polarized. Actually, I don't know what the percentage was, but a good percentage of us later on were anti-war, really was anti-establishment. And not necessarily, you know, marching and stuff like that, but just in our viewpoints, as I say, we had lost our trust. And then questioned almost everything we did. And someplace along the line, we discovered money. Mm. And I'm afraid that we kind of sold our souls for many years in the pursuit of wealth.
So you think in the 80s and the 90s, there was a conformist attitude among a large number of this generation?
Right. And then I was waiting for this generation to stand up when we started the Iraq fiasco. And nothing. And I was very disappointed in both Democrats and Republicans and the just wanting to get along and not make waves. And yet, you know, here we were going again. So I was disappointed. So... That said, now I think more and more of us are retiring, and I'm talking to ones that I come in contact. And being in a little town, I'm limited on who I contact. Mm-hmm. There seems to be more of an interest in serving, and maybe they'll go back because we have the capability.
Right. You have in your personal life served in a lot of areas, a SCORE, Katrina Relief, active in AARP. You see a groundswell of support among your peers, people who will make a difference in increasing numbers?
No, not a groundswell. I mean, just to get people to attend, party meetings or volunteer for organizations. It's always the same faces. I haven't seen too many new ones yet.
Okay.
And so I'm, from my standpoint, the jury's still out on my generation, if they'll get back and re-engage like I really expect them to do. I mean, it's kind of like you opened your mouth, you hopped into the fray. You just can't walk away, and yet we did.
Very good. Bill, I know you have to get back to speaking at a conference. I appreciate you making time for us today. Bill Ibanez talking to us from Luther College in Decorah. Decorah, thank you very much, sir.
You're welcome.
And we're talking with people of the so-called counter culture revolution now that they are approaching or have entered retirement age. Another person we want to talk to before the hour is up, perhaps you want to share your story and your hopes for the counterculture generation as they get older. 1-866-780-9100. Standing by, joining us now at our Des Moines studio of Iowa Public Radio, Mary Ann Young. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
Mary Ann, you are retired from the Iowa Department of Elder Affairs, I understand, and work now primarily on elder advocacy issues, serving also in the AARP's Executive Council. You teach courses on home management of chronic diseases through a grant by Elder Affairs, and you're also on the Iowa Caregivers Association. Theodore Rozak, I think you heard the conversation we had with him in the first half hour, said there will be a revolt of sorts of older, mostly female caregivers emerging in the next 10 years. Do you see that?
Yes, I was listening to Professor Rozak's comments about that. And I guess I'm not sure if I'm anticipating that or not. I guess I do think that the caregiving responsibilities primarily do fall to females. And with families currently in the economic situation that we have, it may not be possible for families to take care of their older loved ones. And so I think there could be a combination of factors that could lead to fewer families being able to provide that care. I don't know if I would call it a revolt necessarily, but I think his comments about the move to a healthcare economy, I think I can see that coming, and the demographics support that.
How will that be different than what we have right now? We've been seeing for many years that healthcare, especially for baby boomers, the elderly, is increasing. The amount of care, the cost of this care just exploding. So what do you see this transforming into? What pressures will happen, and how will we change in that sense?
Well, several things come to mind. Number one, the emphasis at this point on chronic diseases and how we manage those, how we care for those. And I'm grateful for the opportunity to participate in this program that helps teach people how to manage those illnesses. And prevention, I think that with an emphasis on that aspect, many of us will be able to have successful and healthy aging longer. Mm-hmm. Secondly, I think that the crisis will be there will not be enough people to care for older adults who need that kind of support. I certainly see that through the Iowa Caregivers Association and some of the data that they're looking at and projections. You know, there will be a crisis, I believe, in terms of an inadequate number of direct care workers.
Mm-hmm. You teach, as you mentioned, the courses on home management of chronic diseases. So what is the solution, even with these type of courses, even with an increase in the number of nurses giving a service to the elderly, even at home? What is the solution when this crisis comes, when we just can't sustain this anymore? What decisions need to be made?
Well, I think there are several things being done at this point. I think that there are career opportunities in the area of healthcare that need to be addressed, and I think there are some changes going on there. I think that the healthcare reform debate that's going on is trying to address some of those issues as it looks at providing expanded coverage for different aspects of healthcare, especially home care. I think Professor Rozak mentioned that also in his comments. I just think that there has to be incentives for individuals to seek out professions in the healthcare industry, and I don't think that those are there right now.
Marianne Young joining us from the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Des Moines. Stay with us, Mary. Joining us now via telephone from Waterloo, Stephan Kaftan. Stephan is a retired prison warden. He's now an instructor of criminal justice at Hawkeye Community College, where he mentors our future law enforcement officers. He's involved in Boy Scouts, Head Start in Waterloo, and also AARP. Good afternoon to you, Stephan. Thank you for joining us.
Good afternoon, Ben.
You have a unique vantage point on this, our tie into the 1960s. You grew up in Woodstock, New York.
That's correct.
Wow. Tell us about the highlights that you have. You were in your teens when the festival took place. What memories do you have of the people who were there, the kind of social activism that was taking place?
The social activism that was taking place was centered around the whole culture of Woodstock. It has a history of questioning social change, social issues. And, of course, that pinnacle was reached at the Woodstock Music Festival, but it lasted long after that also. I can recall many times where I would go to the Green, and that was a center point in Woodstock, and it was actually a memorial to past war veterans. But it was ironic. I can remember listening to song and public statements from Jimi Hendrix, Bobby Dylan, Joan Collins, Joan Baez, and that was very impressionable on me. They said that we could make a change, we could stand up for things, and that was very, very radical, even for Woodstock. Mm-hmm. And it made me think about the possibilities of how we could make the society better.
So these were Woodstock, the festival, we must remember, took place on a farm, so 40 or 50 miles from Woodstock, New York. But you're talking about being a teenager in the town of Woodstock. It's not a large town, or wasn't at that time. And you are talking with the likes of Joan Baez and Jimi Hendrix, or seeing them on a regular basis?
Yes, sir.
Wow. Take us back to the high point of that counterculture revolution for you. Can you point to a transformative moment, a moment when you might have believed from now on everything in this country must be completely different?
I guess it was a result of my experiences in Woodstock. I felt that this society had to change or was going to crumble, and there was forces that were very much adamantly against those changes. And to tell you the truth, I agree with a former guest, Bill, that we took them seriously in the beginning, and we tried. But along came the 1980s and 1990s, and those same people that were advocating social change, we saw driving foreign cars on Wall Street, and they very much conformed. And I became very disappointed in that.
Mm. So how does that lead you as a person who grew up in Woodstock to become a prison warden? That's a curious path, you have to admit.
Yes. I had an interest in making society better, and I focused my energies within the criminal justice system on a group of individuals who chose not to conform to the law and tried to reform, if you will, their ways. That might sound self-centered, but it was my initial impetus into changing people, changing how we think about how society should operate, what the rules of engagement should be, if you will.
Mm-hmm. So what, you didn't see yourself as yourself giving in to not live up to your ideals and then to work actually for the man?
Correct.
Hmm. What happened to that thinking that you describe, that Bill describes, the generation that didn't succeed in bringing about the change that they dreamt of?
I attribute it to the need for material things. I think The baby boomers were the first generation that were exposed to mass production of television, mass production of electronic gadgets. I think the baby boomers were the first generation to buy into the idea of computerized everything. And we've passed that on to our next generation.
You heard the first half-hour conversation with Professor Theodore Roszak. What do you think about this idea that now the elder culture, formerly the counterculture revolution, could lead a major transformation in our society now that they are more, many are financially independent, past the main working years of their life, with this experience behind them of the 60s?
Well, I agree with that. And I'll key on a word that the professor said. It could be. It can be. We have a potential there. We have 77 million baby boomers, and that's an awful lot of energy that can be used for the impetus of social change, healthcare reform, and the list can go on and on. But to be very honest with you, I still believe a majority of those baby boomers don't recognize what they can do due to the lack of knowledge of volunteerism, because they are consumed, if you will, with their lives, their children's lives, and maybe their grandchildren's lives. And that's okay. But I think they should take a step back and say, okay, how can I contribute to the better cause of society?
Let me turn back to Marianne Young, who is an advocate for elder issues, also serving on AARP's executive council. I know both of you are involved with AARP. Marianne, Theodore Roszak predicts that organizations like AARP will lead a transformation in the country. You serve on the AARP's executive council. What are the biggest agenda items for the future as far as AARP is concerned?
Well, of course, health care is certainly one of the number one issues, and access to health care and economic sufficiency. And so those areas, as we look to the current programs of Social Security and Medicare and what the future holds for those programs, I think are critically important. And also being a better educated consumer, a better educated older adult. And I think that we as consumers have a responsibility, just as we have a responsibility for our health also. We need to be very conscious, you know, of a healthy lifestyle. We need to be very conscious, I think, of our economic situation. And I think we just need to be better educated all around. I certainly support Stefan's comments, too, about volunteerism. And I think many people don't know that those opportunities are out there. And so I think we want to make sure that people have those opportunities, that they know about them. And I think the opportunity to give back to society, and I think Professor Roszak mentioned recapturing some of the energy and vitality of our younger years. Mm-hmm. I think that now that we are out of the some of us anyway are out of the workforce, we need to look at that energy and where can we best use that energy, whether it's at the local level or the state level or whatever level we can access that and to make a difference.
Mm-hmm. We just have a minute or so left. I wanted to get both of your reflections quickly on what Professor Roszak also mentioned about the fact that this generation, your generation, is not in an adversarial generation with the young generation today. What are your reflections on the young people of today? How are they like or unlike the counterculture generation, your generation? Let me turn to you, first of all, Stefan.
Very good question. Because I deal with the younger generation on a day-to-day basis here at Hawkeye Community College, I see great potential. They are utilizing technology like it's never been utilized before. The younger generation knows much more, can instantaneously find out what is happening in Copenhagen during the summit, and information is instantaneous. And how they will use it in the future will be very interesting to me to observe. How they will use that information, will they use it wisely? Will they use it for the good of society, of mankind? And I see great potential.
We've run out of time. We'll have to leave it there. Thank you, Stefan Kaftan, joining us from Waterloo. It's been a pleasure talking with you, Stefan.
thank you very much. I enjoyed the time.
And also thank you, Marianne Young, at our Des Moines studio of Iowa Public Radio. Thank you for sharing your thoughts as well.
Thank you, Ben.
And we want to take you out with a little music reminiscent of the counterculture revolution and mention that our program is produced by Catherine Perkins and Jeff Schmidt, producer assistant today, Christina Sarnelli, and technical support from Dennis Reese as well. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Dennis, take us back to the 60s.
Come gather around, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing. Some writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin, and there's no telling who that it's naming. For the loser now will be later to win, for the times, they are a-changin'.